This is Philosophy Bites with me, Nigel Warburton.
And me, David Edmonds.
Philosophy Bites is unfunded. Please help us keep it going by subscribing or donating at www.philosophybites.com, or you can become a patron at Patreon.
What is a woman? That's not a question that has puzzled people for much of human history. But in the 20th century, some feminists, most notably the French philosopher Simone de Beauvoir, drew a distinction between female biology and what it is to be a woman. Women are not born women, thought de Beauvoir. Society makes them so. But this issue has been further complicated by a relatively new debate. How should we categorise trans people, those who have a gender identity that differs from their sex? It's a question that has caused a bitter rift among feminists, with one faction arguing that just identifying as a woman is not enough to make you a woman. Here's Amir Srinivasan.
Amir Srinivasan, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thanks very much.
The topic we're going to focus on is, what is a woman? Now, for many people, it's fairly obvious what a woman is. What is the philosophical question there?
I think you're right. So it's fair to say that for most of human history, the question, what is a woman, would just seem like a silly question because the answer would have seemed very obvious. A woman is an adult human female. A woman is the member of the human species who has ovaries, who produces eggs, who nurses young, who gives birth to young, and so on. So the reigning assumption has been that woman is a biological category. In 1949, the French philosopher Simone de Beauvoir published a book called The Second Sex, in which she proposed that while being female is a biological category, being a woman is not. She famously said that one is not born, but rather becomes a woman. So the idea here is that a human can be born female or born male, but that human has to somehow become, through a process of socialization, a particular gender, a woman or a man. And so while sex, for Beauvoir, is a natural thing, gender is a socially constructed thing.
What does that mean, it's socially constructed? Are we saying that society imposes a role upon a woman, or that different societies impose different roles on women? What does it mean?
So that's a very good question. And feminists since Beauvoir have disagreed over the question of just what kind of socialization is involved in becoming a woman. But the general view has been that there is some kind of coercive process at work whereby biologically female humans are forced to act in particular stereotypically feminine ways, including dress, including ways of speaking, including being deferential to men, and a whole host of other things that we associate with femininity.
Does that mean that all women are constructed in the same way, that actually all women are connected in this way because they've had the same kind of view of femininity thrust upon them?
So that's a really excellent question. And that question has been at the heart of feminism over the last few decades. So for someone like Simone de Beauvoir, I think the answer is largely yes. She thought that there was something that all women shared in virtue of going through a common process of socialization. Specifically, she thought one becomes a woman by being othered by men. For men, in order to achieve a sense of their own selves, their own subjecthood, it's required that they posit women as the other, as secondary. Therefore, the title of her book, The Second Sex. And I think it's fair to say that Beauvoir thought that general experience was pretty uniform across women, although, of course, she'll recognize differences between particular women.
So Beauvoir was an existentialist, famously. And so presumably she believed that whether you accept the role that other people put upon you is an individual choice. Otherwise, you're in a kind of bad faith.
So you're absolutely right that Beauvoir was an existentialist and as such believed in a profound ability for humans to act freely, even in a context of social coercion and oppression. And so while women were forced to become women and therefore act in certain ways, she also thought that women could liberate themselves from this and could achieve their own sense of subjecthood.
She's interesting in comparison with Jean-Paul Sartre because he tended to underplay social factors. I think Simone de Beauvoir was much more sensitive to the ways in which society shapes who we are.
Yeah, that's a great observation. And I also think any feminist would tell you that that's unsurprising. So it's easy for someone in a dominant position, like a rich white man, such as Sartre, to think of himself as purely free and unconstrained by society. Whereas someone like Beauvoir, who, although privileged in many ways, was shackled by her gender, will always include in her analysis a theory of social constraint.
Simone de Beauvoir published The Second Sex in 1949, I think, and there's been a lot of feminist writing on the topic of what is a woman since then. Is there anything important that sort of follows on from de Beauvoir?
There's been a huge amount of writing in feminism on the question of the social construction of gender. And most feminists have accepted Beauvoir's distinction between sex and gender, and along with Beauvoir, think of gender as something socially constructed. There is a lot of disagreement within feminism about whether gender is something that we would ideally abolish. So Beauvoir thinks that gender really exists. She's not a nominalist about gender, but she thinks it only exists because we perpetuate the system that allows it to exist. So that theoretically opens up the place for abolishing gender altogether. And so an important question in feminism has been, should we seek ultimately to abolish gender, to make it the case that there are no longer men and women, or is there some reason to keep around the categories of women and men?
Just to get this clear, sex is the biological given, determined by your genes, recognised by the kind of genitals that you have, the kind of secondary sexual characteristics. Gender is a socially constructed overlay on that. So there is a masculine view of the world thrust upon me as a man from the time that I was a boy, and women tend to be brought up with certain preconceptions about the limits of what they should or shouldn't do, and that constructs their femininity in the way that de Beauvoir would have discussed this. Now, how could somebody seriously get away from gender? It's such a dominant aspect of human life across the world. It would be very strange to just abolish gender altogether.
No doubt it would be strange to abolish gender, and a world without gender would be profoundly different from ours. But so would a world without racism, and so would a world without economic oppression. So the sort of feminism that seeks to abolish gender sees the abolition of gender as a regulative ideal, something we should aspire to, but that we are probably quite far away from still.
Now, one of the very prominent thinkers in the area of gender is Judith Butler. I wonder if you could give a sense of where she stands on some of these issues.
In 1990, Judith Butler wrote a very important book called Gender Trouble, in which she proposed that gender isn't something we have. It's not that I have a gender or that I am a woman, but rather gender is something we do. It's a strange thing to say, but Butler essentially thinks that I do woman through a series of performative acts of femininity. How I dress, how I talk, how I relate to other people, how I think of myself in the world. Butler does not think that we are all aware that we are performing our gender. She thinks we're largely unaware. For most of us, it just feels like we are women or we are men. This isn't something we're actively constructing and doing. So it's not that we are all consciously, voluntarily playing a role. It's that we find ourselves playing a particular gender role and indeed are compelled and coerced by society into playing that role. That said, for Butler, there is an element of voluntariness, just as there is with Beauvoir. Butler thinks there is the possibility of taking control, some limited amount of control over our own gender performativity. And specifically, she thinks that we can subvert the gender system by acting in ways that are unexpected or that don't conform with the standard views of how a woman should behave or a man should behave.
Does she actually advocate these revolutionary acts that you do something unexpected so that you force people to be aware? It's almost Brechtian, isn't it? The sort of drawing to attention of the roles that are being played and the degree to which this is a social construction.
I think it's certainly fair to say that Butler celebrates those kinds of revolutionary acts. She, of course, understands that such revolutionary and subversive acts come with different costs for different people. And so she would be reluctant, I think, to say that everyone ought to try to subvert the gender system. A lot of people die when they try and subvert the gender system. But nonetheless, I think it is true that Butler takes hope from certain kinds of subversive gender acts and wants us to celebrate them.
Another really interesting development in feminism is the notion of intersectionality. That's something that's a result of the thinking in the 1980s and is quite different from de Beauvoir's approach to what it is to be a woman.
That's right. I think it's fair to say that intersectionality is the most important thing that has happened in recent feminism. So you see an intersectional turn within feminism happening, as you said, in the 80s and the 90s, mostly thanks to black feminists. Kimberly Crenshaw, a black feminist, coined the term intersectionality. So what does it mean? An intersectional approach to feminism attends to the multiple axes of oppression or privilege that an individual person can instantiate. So women aren't all the same, because women vary by class, they vary by ethnicity, race, disability status, and so on. So a common trope in second wave feminism, the feminism that was dominant in the 60s and the 70s, is that women don't have access to the workplace, and that working is an essential part of the emancipation of women. But this implicitly takes for granted that the experience of white middle-class women is the experience of all women. Because while it's true that white middle-class women don't have access, or at least didn't have access to the workplace, working-class white women and black women were already in the workforce. So intersectional feminism draws attention to the ways in which one's particular experience of being a woman is going to be inflected by one's race, ethnicity, class, disability status, and so on. Specifically, if one is oppressed as a black woman, one isn't oppressed simply as a woman and as a black person. One has a particular experience of oppression as a black woman. And that's the key intersectional insight. Now, intersectionality poses a certain kind of problem for thinking about the social construction of womanhood. Because on an orthodox feminist way of thinking about the social construction of women, women had a common experience, a common social experience that made them into women. But once you start recognizing the diversity of women's experience, it's not clear that you can identify a common social process that produces women.
Does that mean you should then revert to a kind of feminism with many subdivisions? So you have a feminism of a black working class woman and so on, that it actually breaks down into a kind of multifaceted kind of feminism rather than the sort of feminism which says there is a condition shared by all women.
Well, this has been the question. How can we take very seriously the diversity of women's experience while yet having a feminism that is supposed to speak for and to and advocate on behalf of all women? Some feminists would simply say, yes, you need a more fractured feminism with shifting coalitions and solidarities. Another approach would hope to identify something that all women share, regardless of the diversity of experience.
Presumably, this has been complicated recently by the increasing visibility of trans women and trans men and the difficulty of fitting people into simple categories when the categories seem to be multiplied.
You're absolutely right. Trans women and trans men have, of course, existed for a long time, but feminism has recently been under pressure to politically accommodate and vindicate the reality, especially of trans women. A trans woman is a woman, someone who identifies as a woman, who feels herself really to be a woman, just as I feel myself to be a woman, but who at birth, and perhaps for a long time after that, was identified by those people around her as a man or as a boy, usually on the basis of what might be called male biology. So on the orthodox feminist view of gender as a social construction, the kind of view that Simone de Beauvoir put forward, women are women in virtue of a shared experience of a certain kind of social process, socialization as women. Now, this thesis stands in some tension with the idea that trans women are really women. For a trans woman who has only recently transitioned, how can it be that she was always a woman?
So I can understand that on those sorts of grounds, some orthodox feminists, some traditional feminists might have a difficulty accepting trans women as genuinely women. Is there any way in which you could argue that they really are women and have always been women?
Yes, I think you can. And I think it's very important for feminism to rethink the question of what is a woman in light of the experience of trans women. I'd like to offer maybe two different ways of addressing that challenge, namely the challenge of vindicating the reality of trans women as women while holding on to a constructivist notion of gender. So the first way is to draw on intersectionality. So an intersectional analysis tells us that the experience of women is really, really diverse. So not all women will have gone through, for example, the experience of getting their periods, or having been catcalled, or birth, although this might be true for many women. So once we recognize that women can have really diverse experiences, we can think of the childhood of a trans woman, a childhood in which she was misgendered as a boy, treated as a boy, as just another kind of girlhood.
You said there were two ways in which we can possibly acknowledge that trans women really are women in the same sense that you are a woman.
So the second way has to do with rethinking what it is we're asking when we ask the question, what is a woman? So when Beauvoir asks that question, or Butler asks that question, they're asking it as a metaphysical question. What sort of thing, metaphysically speaking, is a woman? What sort of thing in the world does the concept woman pick out? That's to ask a descriptive question. But we can also ask a prescriptive question. What sort of concept of woman should we have, politically speaking and morally speaking? And you might think, and I do think, that the category of woman we should have is a very inclusive category and should include all of those people who identify as women.
So you're saying that the category of womanhood is actually a kind of call to solidarity, and it's almost self-defining. If you think of yourself as a woman, then you are, by definition, a woman.
I think it's exactly right. Feminism is a political movement. And political movements need to think about who they're including and who they're excluding. A feminism that isn't inclusive is just not a very good feminism, politically or morally speaking. So I do think that for political purposes, for the very central purposes of feminism, we should think about the question, what is a woman, in terms of what should our solidarities be? Who we want to include in our fight against the patriarchy. And I think it's very clear that trans women should be centrally involved in that fight.
Amir Srinivasan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more Philosophy Bites, go to www.philosophybites.com. You can also find details there of Philosophy Bites books and how to support us. We now have two more podcasts. Nigel has one on philosophers and places they're associated with, www.philosophysites.com, and I have a podcast devoted specifically to moral and political philosophy, www.philosophy247.org.